Meeting will come to order, and we have, first of all, we need some brave soul to move the minutes. Sandin?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move the minutes of the previous meeting.
All right. All in favor of that?
Aye.
Please signify aye. Same sign, no. Okay. Minutes are adopted. The first item of business then is House File 211. And Representative Rosenthal, would you like to move the bill so we have it before the committee? Representative Beinert, you have gathered a huge crowd here today to listen to your bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sure they're here to see you. thank you, Mr. Chair, and members for having us here today. I'm happy to have the opportunity to present House File 211 to you today. Many of you may already be aware of Highway 14. Certainly, if you've been around the Capitol, you've heard about it before. Some of you live with the issues around Highway 14. As many of you know, Highway 14 is a regional priority. It serves regional centers all across southern Minnesota, from Rochester, Owatonna, Waseca, Mankato, North Mankato, and New Ulm. Communities, businesses, and individuals all along the corridor are united in our commitment to completing this highway. We've been at it for 40 years now. A consistent four-lane corridor from Rochester to New Ulm is the only solution that meets the long-term safety and economic needs of southern Minnesota. We deeply appreciate that last summer, Governor Dayton committed to completing the four-lane expansion of Highway 14 from North Mankato to Nicolet, but that's only a few short miles of the long distance between New Ulm and Rochester. This piece of the project will begin in 2017, but we can't let the progress stop there. We need to make sure that MnDOT puts the full four-lane expansion of Highway 14 back in its 20-year state highway investment plan, which is scheduled to be finalized in August. Highway 14 has been included in past versions of the statewide plan and MnDOT District 6 and 7 plans, including the most recent versions. The plans have noted the needs for the safety and capacity improvements on Highway 14, but usually listed the project for late within the 20-year period or as an unfunded investment need. However, MnDOT's investment strategy is moving away from expansion projects toward less expensive fixes. So we are concerned. The 20-year plan prioritizes how state and federal transportation resources will be invested. Any current or future transportation funding will first be allocated to projects that are included in this planning document. So House File 211 directs MnDOT to list Highway 14, as it has been listed in the past, as a priority in the 20-year plan. If Highway 14 is left off the plan, progress to complete the regional corridor will be stalled, economic opportunity will be lost, driver safety will be jeopardized, and project costs will only increase. With that in mind, I have several individuals who know directly the importance of Highway 14 for their cities and communities who will talk about completing Highway 14. First, I'd like to introduce Amanda Dewar of the U.S. Highway 14 Partnership.
Ms. Dewar?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Amanda Dewar with the U.S. Highway 14 Partnership. Thank you very much for allowing us the time to be here today. I just wanted to briefly convey to you, I have a map included in your handout. When we talk about completing Highway 14, we are talking about two segments between Rochester and New Ulm that are in need of an upgrade from two lanes to four lanes, and those are between Dodge Center and Owatonna and New Ulm and Nicollet. And as Representative Reinert mentioned earlier, the governor did commit last summer that Highway 14 between North Mankato and Nicollet will be upgraded to four lanes in 2017 or 2018. So that portion of the project is highlighted in green on your map, but the unfinished segments are in red. And I also, there are several members of the U.S. Highway 14 Partnership that wanted to be here today that weren't able, so I included letters from them in your packet, but just wanted to pull out a few brief points. First, from Audra Shaneman, the CEO and president of the New Ulm Area Chamber of Commerce. A few points. Hello from New Ulm. Our largest employers are Kraft, 3M, New Ulm Medical Center, and Associated Milk Producers, with manufacturing jobs providing approximately 25% of the employment in our area. While our population hovers at 13,500 citizens, these are great indicators of our economic potential. A $25 million capital investment is planned for one of our manufacturing plants. Martin Luther College has plans to build a 50-unit senior housing facility and expand their early childhood learning center. The New Ulm Medical Center is embarking on a $5.3 million expansion of their clinic facilities and has added 10 practitioners in the last 15 months, and a new Menards is opening in March of 2013. For our manufacturing plants and the estimated 1,000 trucks that are dispatched out of New Ulm, Highway 14 is the primary route to connect New Ulm to major highways like I-90 and I-35. She goes on to say, New Ulm is being seen more and more as a regional center for shopping, education, and healthcare. For our economic stability and ability to grow, we need Highway 14 to be expanded to four lanes. Please support the inclusion of Highway 14 in the MnDOT State Highway Investment Plan. And then another letter I have from Aaron Lambrecht, who is the owner of Shelter Products, Inc., based out of New Ulm. I live on Highway 14 near Nicollet and experience the dangerous conditions at least twice every day. These conditions are such that my wife and I refuse to allow our children to ride the school bus in the afternoon, as they would have to cross both lanes of traffic. There is no way in our right minds we will allow this. My wife has had to adjust her work schedule to be able to transport our children to and from school. Goes on to say, our company is involved in the sale and delivery of building materials throughout the state of Minnesota and the four surrounding states. We feel that we are hindered in our opportunity for growth because of the high cost of transporting materials in and out of New Ulm. We compete with many other distributors who are fortunate to be located on four-lane highways and other parts of the region. These folks have a competitive advantage over us in their cost structure. This will lead to us looking at other states and regions, allowing us to grow as a company. And finally, last night I was contacted by Beth Hodgman, whose husband is one of the fatalities that we talk about on Highway 14. And she writes, on November 6, 2012, my husband Scott D. Hodgman was killed traveling on Highway 14. He was on his way home from work and heading to vote. He was a hardworking, loving, honest family man, and he was taken from his family. His vehicle and another vehicle collided head-on, killing three people total and injuring one. The other two people who were killed were the 10-year-old boy and his father, a hardworking family man also. I know this accident could have been avoided if this deadly stretch of Highway 14 would have been a four-lane. I know if Highway 14 was a four-lane, my children, my grandchildren, myself, and our entire family would still have Scott here with us. Now I would like to turn it over to Mayor Tom Kuntz of Owatonna.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mayor Tom Kuntz, mayor of the great city of Owatonna, and here to talk about my favorite subject, Highway 14. Welcome. Highway 14 is have people needlessly losing their lives. From 2002 to 2011, 52 fatalities, 41 serious injury crashes occurred between Rochester and New Ulm. In 2012, we had 8 fatalities and 4 serious injuries, including a 10-year-old boy that had received chemo and was returning home from Mayo Clinic. I don't think there is anybody that lives in the section of 14 from New Ulm to Rochester that doesn't know somebody that has either been injured or killed along Highway 14. So it needs to be taken care of. It needs to be, something needs to happen. I also have a concern about the EIS. The EIS was completed, or the environmental impact study was completed in August of 2010. The environmental impact study showed the location of the proposal of the new highway going from Owatonna to Dodge Center. No action has been taken on this EIS or the Highway 14, and with that said, if it's no actions taken within 3 years, it would expire. After it expires, you have to do another EIS, or you have to do an update of that. The longer the process goes on that we need to do an update, the more expensive that's going to be to refigure the new EIS or make modifications to it. You know, when the EIS was done in 2010, we had high hopes that we would be able to see some dollars attributed to Highway 14 going forward. That hasn't occurred. We don't even have it on the 20-year plan, so that is very, very frustrating. When we had the ribbon cutting in, from Owatonna to Waseca this last year, we had hopes that we'd be able to get the other sections from New Ulm to North Mankato and from Owatonna to Dodge Center back on the 20-year plan. That is not on the 20-year plan. That is very, very frustrating. As we continue to do economic development within our communities along Highway 14, we've been fortunate enough to get a couple companies come to Owatonna, and their anticipation of coming to Owatonna was that they would be able to service southern Minnesota using four-lane highways from Owatonna to Rochester to New Ulm, and that's not the case. They're very disappointed that that access isn't there. In reference to the lady that we just talked about losing her husband, she also called me with all the information that's going on Highway 14, and she felt that accident would not have occurred. The accident occurred when they were driving from east going west, and they were just leaving the Highway 14 section that was four-lane going into the two-lane. They were traveling from east, from west going to east into Rochester. The car that was coming from going to the west side got off of the four-lane highway. It was onto the two-lane highway, and they were scheduled to be going about 70 miles an hour. So I think a lot of people anticipate that they forget about the two-lane highway and the four-lane highway, and that's just another traffic snare that's not that shouldn't be allowed. It should be four-lane highway all the way. The other thing she was always saying is that when you're driving on a two-lane highway, you're driving at sunlight and sunset, that glare from the roads are very, very distracting. If you could have that as a four-lane highway, you wouldn't have that issue with the glare and worry about which way the traffic's coming and how close you're going to be to the center line. So thank you for your time.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Noreen Otto, and I am here on behalf of Hy-Vee. Hy-Vee has 16 stores located across southern Minnesota and over 5,000 employees in the state of Minnesota. Half of those stores are located along the Highway 14 corridor. We are unique as a company in that we control much of our chain of distribution. We have a fleet of trucks who make the deliveries to our store. We have over 500 drivers who annually log over 30 million miles across the Midwest. We have about 81,000 outbound loads from the company, in addition to another 42,000 loads that are backhauled. Those are done in partnership with companies throughout the Midwest, including several large companies here in Minnesota. Safe, dependable access to our stores is paramount in our operations. We can't function without product being able to arrive on time and in a safe manner. And even more importantly than that, our store directors here in the state express concern about their employees' ability to travel to and from work. You know, our towns and smaller communities really do draw from the surrounding areas. We're talking about regional development and the support of a regional workforce. It's really important to us that Highway 14 be an investment for the state of Minnesota as we look forward to making millions and millions of dollars of capital investment in these towns dotted along Highway 14. So we ask the committee to consider the inclusion in the 20-year MnDOT plan and look at this as a regional issue for these employers across the state. At this point, I'd like to introduce Patrick Baker from Greater Mankato Growth. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members, my name is Patrick Baker, and I'm the Director of Government and Institutional Affairs for Greater Mankato Growth. The Chamber of Commerce and Economic Development, serving over 800 members, in the greater Mankato area. I'm here on behalf of Jonathan Zert, our president and CEO, who is unable to make it today. I'm honored to be here, and I look forward to sharing with you how Highway 14 is an important corridor that greater Mankato area and all of southern Minnesota rely on for our economic vitality. Highway 14 is a vital economic lifeline for our region that countless businesses and individuals rely on for the movement of goods, as well as themselves and their families. This is particularly true for thousands of individuals who utilize Highway 14 each day as the primary east-west corridor to commute to and from home, work in Mankato, North Mankato. In fact, we recently surveyed a Mankato-based manufacturer that employs 345 individuals, and of those employees, 51% live somewhere else besides the cities of Mankato and North Mankato. I can tell you from personal experience that if you drive out of Mankato in the morning either direction, you will face an uninterrupted stream of headlights coming your way. I also know from my interactions with many Mankato-based businesses that currently use Highway 14 for moving their goods and employees that they are becoming increasingly concerned with delays and dangerous intersections that the two unfinished segments cause. The concerns over safety and congestion will only increase in intensity as population and economic growth along Highway 14 is expected to be significant. According to the state demographer, five of the counties along the corridor, Blue Earth, Dodge, Nicollet, Olmsted, and Steele counties, will experience population growth ranging from 13% to 33% by 2030. This also means that the regional economy along Highway 14 corridor will need to expand. Indeed, projections show traffic along the North Mankato to New Ulm segment will grow 60 to 80% by 2025, and the Owatonna to Dodge Center segment will grow over 50% by 2034. This growth is especially pronounced in industries most dependent on transportation infrastructure. According to Deed, by 2020, special freight trucking will increase 50 to 57%, building equipment contracting by 43 to 54%, general trucking will increase, medical offices will increase 30 to 32%, and general freight trucking by 21%. Mankato will be a significant contributor to this growth, as Walmart has identified Mankato as the site of its next Midwest distribution facility, with construction scheduled to start on that in the near term. Our region obviously welcomes this population and economic growth, but we know it will add to the traffic volume, congestion, and safety concerns along Highway 14. In closing, let me leave you with this. Greater Mankato businesses have invested more than $250 million over the past 3 years in capital projects. As our businesses make these significant investments and our region continues to grow even bigger and become an even bigger contributor to the state economy, we expect our public partners to do their share and make the necessary investments in infrastructure. Going forward, it's critical that Highway 14 be a top state priority to ensure that we have adequate infrastructure that enables future economic opportunities and improves safety along the corridor. Thank you for your time. And I'd now like to introduce Mayor Bob Boozman from the great city of New Ulm.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Bob Boozman, and I am the mayor of the city of New Ulm. In 2012, MnDOT performed a safety audit on Highway 14 between New Ulm and North Mankato. This study revealed that severe crashes along this stretch of highway are three times the expected crash rate along rural two-lane roads. The report also identified numerous unsafe intersections. It recommended that the intersection of Highway 14 and 15 in New Ulm be upgraded to an interchange in 2018 when the adjacent New Ulm Bridge is reconstructed. Living in this area all of my life, we call that area the Y. Some people call it the Y because that's how the road kind of switches off into a Y. But for the last 40 years, people have been saying, why? Why can't this be fixed? This intersection project is currently not planned and remains unfunded. We need to make sure that this project is included in the plan and resources are directed to this important safety improvement. The MnDOT safety audit also showed Highway 14 between North Mankato and Nicollet had nearly 1.5 the heavy commercial traffic compared to the statewide rural average, 12.6 versus 8.9%. There are approximately 1,000 to 1,200 trucks based out of New Ulm. Four-lane expansion of Highway 14 is important for New Ulm's economic competitiveness, so our businesses can safely and efficiently move their products and provide services. You heard from our representative of Hy-Vee, one of our grocery stores in New Ulm. We are very, very competitive in the whole area with our grocery prices. We have people coming from a whole regional area because of the fact that we have a Hy-Vee store in the city of New Ulm. If we can't, if they can't get their products to us in a timely and safe method, I worry about whether they're going to continue to stay with us. I'm hoping they do. Several of my friends have either seen, been involved in, or in one case, one of my best friends at the Y, the 1415 intersection, actually left us three times on the way to Rochester on the helicopter ride. Serious car accident. Sun was shining. We still don't know who didn't see what, but he saw nothing until he woke up in the hospital. He had no idea that he was even in a car crash. He's up and alive yet, but boy, it was touch and go for quite a while. Over 40 years ago, a study designated this section of Highway 14 as one of the most dangerous roads in Minnesota. 40 years ago. Still is. In conclusion, you've heard here that Highway 14 is not just a priority of New Ulm, but all of southern Minnesota. Highway 14 serves mainly important economic hubs, Rochester, Owatonna, Waseca, Greater Mankato, and New Ulm. All these communities are united in completing a four-lane corridor to connect our cities. Businesses, individuals, cities, and counties from all along the corridor have rallied together to support the finishing of Highway 14. The longer the four-lane expansion is put off, the more lives will be lost. The more expensive these projects will become, the more regional economic growth will be gone forever. We need to fix Highway 14 now, and we ask for your support in doing so. MnDOT must include Highway 14 in its 20-year plan so that we can make progress on completing this four-lane corridor. Thank you very much for your time and attention.
Thank you. Questions from the Representative Petersburg?
Thank you, Chairman Earhart and others. I am a co-sponsor of this, co-author of this bill as well, and I do find it very needing of to being done. A couple of things that I would just remind us all. First of all, I understand that we don't generally like to tell the Department of Transportation what to put into their program, but in this particular case, it's already been in the program, and they have chosen to pull it out for various reasons or changes in how they determine it. But I would also like to at least remind us that earlier today we heard from an Itasca project at another transportation committee in which they said transportation systems impacts the economic health and vitality of a region. And certainly this is the case here. They further on went on to say employers are drawn to areas with access to more potential employees within a 30-minute commute. And if you know the area, most of our towns are 30 minutes or more apart, and so that's going to be true of this particular area as well. But when you add on top of it the safety concerns in which right now that stretch of road is about 35% more dangerous than the roads in general, and we're trying to get information as to how they are compared to the streets and roads in Minneapolis area. I think it's important for us to know that this is a dangerous stretch that we need to understand is part of our responsibility to provide for as well. I was when I was going to high school in the 1960s, I'm sorry, that puts me kind of old, but in the 1960s, we were told that Highway 14 was going to be finished, shortly, in front of us, which was from Dodge Center to Claremont and then into Owatonna. Well, if you do the math, 1970 even to today is close to 50 years, 40-some years anyway. So it's been in the 20-year plan for that long, and it's when does it finally get out of that 20-year plan and get done? And I think that's the question we're just looking for here. So thank you for the commentary.
Let's see, Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Breinert, I'm looking through the information, and I don't think I've heard, at least, the number of miles involved. Could you describe the project, number of miles, number of bridges, and so on? I see that it's a very expensive project, according to this sheet. $200 million for the one link, and somewhere between $80 and $165 million for the second piece. That's what it says here. But, I mean, how? What's the number of miles and
Representative Beiner?
Number of bridges?
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, I'll let Ms. Dewar speak to the miles, but I want to say something about for the cost of the project. And what we're asking for in this committee is the policy piece of having the project included in the 20-year plan. And the issue here, and MnDOT certainly maybe has spoken to you about this and will do so again, but there is a transition in the way their approach to the 20-year plan. And some argue that no projects ought to be identified in the 20-year plan, but the fact is some are identified, and if any are, we want to be identified. So it's simply we want to be at the table so that when dollars do come available, we're eligible for them. So whether the project will be fully funded or how and when is a separate question from whether the project should be included in the 20-year plan. But I'll let the mileage and the bridge issue, I'll let Ms. Dewar speak.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, the New Ulm to North Mankato segment, that's about 22 miles. The governor committed to the Nicollet to North Mankato, so that's about 6 miles. So about 16 miles we're looking for there, and then another 16 miles between Owatonna and Dodge Center. Oh, the whole corridor is like 110 miles, I believe, total.
Sure. Well, Mr. Chair, and thank you. And I know this is about policy, but it does. I mean, it just seems to me that it's, you know, it's not a very long piece of roadway, 16 and 16. So, you know, it's amazing that it's been so long and we can't get it done and. And the costs keep going up, and it would be interesting to see it move forward.
You know, one of the reasons the cost keeps going up is that MnDOT has now clarified that as a freeway, not an expressway.
Would you give him the mic so he could sit? Sorry, Mike, but you are, Tom, you won't be on the recording.
Oh, okay. Yeah, one of the reasons MnDOT has taken the past sections of it and it's been an expressway. The new one is going to be a freeway, which means that there's more bridges involved, more the bridges every mile in order to get the crossroads going across. So that's why the expense from Owatonna to Dodge Center has been driven up so high. Mm-hmm. That's because it's a freeway designation.
Representative Beiner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, if you drove the section from North Mankato to New Ulm, you'd have a good sense of why it's expensive. It's a difficult section of road, which is why it's so dangerous. Mm-hmm. It's not a straightforward, and it's going to take some re-engineering to make it a safer route, but I think that's the primary issue is the configuration of the
Any other,
Mr. Chair, just to follow up.
Representative Runbeck.
So the issue then, maybe the mayor could answer, but is the entire 110 miles going to be a freeway, or just this piece? Or I mean, why the difference?
The Representative Runbeck, Mr. Chair, no, the planning documents, the EIS for the North Mankato to New Ulm section have that as an expressway as well, but the Owatonna to Dodge Center has been chosen as a freeway, so. Mm.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Anybody in the audience that would like to testify for or against this proposition? I have one question for MnDOT in case they happen to be here watching what's happening. Why are we downgrading this thing, which has been around now for almost 20 years? Because if you say what I think you're going to say, then I'm going to ask some people to contribute to the next time we have a funding bill.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Scott Peterson from MnDOT. I think it was already alluded to
earlier by one of the presenters that we are in a transition period and changing kind of the way we do our 20-year highway investment plan, and this is our first time through. In prior plans, we had produced a set of performance-oriented investment priorities, and then also listed a number of projects that we weren't able to fund in the 20-year time because of funding constraints, and so they were listed but unfunded and identified as part of a funding gap that existed in order to meet our performance goals. In the current iteration of the Minnesota State Highway Investment Plan, we are identifying projects in the first 10 years subject to our forecasted fiscal constraints. And so we're listing projects. The first 4 years is what's in our state transportation improvement program, commonly known as a STIP. The second 6 years is part of our highway work program. And in the 10 years beyond that, so from years 11 through 20, we are not listing projects in this current version of the plan. We are simply identifying amounts of money that would need to be invested in certain investment categories in order to meet our investment or in order to make progress towards our targets. And this is intended to be a more pragmatic plan, and that is oriented toward producing an actual plan of projects and work that we could do subject to what we expect to be our financial constraints. And so as a result, anything that we can't, any projects or improvements that we can't fit within the first 10-year of our first 10 years of our plan, where our current expectations that we would not list projects beyond 10 years. And I just also like to point out that we are still in the middle of the planning process. We haven't predetermined which projects will be listed or not listed within that first 10 years of the plan either.
Well, I know this is not your fault, but the logic of what NNDOT is doing here escapes me, because you could list your projects as zero and you would have a funding surplus and you'd give money back. So if you don't want to strike out and move ahead with what has to be done, you're safe. But if you want to get these projects done, and this will not fall on your ears as a culprit, but somebody over in there in that big building has got to make some decisions about some of this stuff. Thank you.
You're welcome, Mr. Chairman.
I'm going to lay this bill over for possible inclusion. Excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Chair, can I ask a question of Mr. Peterson? Sorry about that. I just have one question. Since I've been in the legislature, I've heard about Highway 14 as being one of the deadliest highways. And is there statistics that says that it truly is?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mason, certainly there are safety issues on Highway 14. The last time that I looked at data, statewide crash data for segments and intersections, there were a significant number of parts of the state trunk highway system that actually had worse safety records than most of this area of trunk Highway 14 that's covered by the bill before you.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Beiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a statistic I'm aware of is the crash rate on especially the section from North Mankato to New Ulm is nearly twice the state average crash rate for a similar highway.
Thank you. And I again say I lay over this for possible inclusion as House File 211. And thank you all. Next up is House File 487, Representative Hausman. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you moving the bill?
We'll find somebody to do that. Is there anybody here that will move this bill? Representative Hornstein.
I would be happy to move the bill.
And, Mr. Chair, I have an author's amendment which puts the bill in the form that we wish to present it to you. The bill itself simply authorizes local authorities to regulate traffic at intersections using traffic safety cameras. The author's amendment is 0054, and it
I will move A130054.
And that gets the bill before you, as we'll be presenting it.
All in favor of that motion?
Aye.
Opposed? You're on.
This makes clear, the amendment makes clear that we record clear images of both vehicle movement and the driver of the vehicle. And then if you look at Section 3, any fine or penalty shall in no instance exceed a petty misdemeanor. Any government entity which regulates traffic by means of these cameras must post signage notifying the drivers that traffic safety cameras are in place to make sure that, that's identified at every intersection where there's a camera. All data collected are private and may be retained for a maximum of 30 days after the final adjudication, and a contract with the private entity must comply with that as well. So that is the those are the additional changes we made. And Mr. Chair and members, this is one of those situations where I think every one of us, if we had a preference, we'd probably happily have a police officer at every corner, particularly every dangerous corner. But you know from your cities that, in fact, is not happening. It would be great if we could afford it. I don't know if we are ready to raise property taxes to that level to hire those police officers, if we're ready as a state to provide more local government aid so that local governments can hire those police officers to enforce our traffic laws, laws that are designed to protect us from dangerous and deadly behavior, like running red lights. But we can't. There are lots of other challenges that we face, a little money to do it, and that's true for local governments as well. But here's the statistic that we need to face. In Minnesota, over 7,500 people were injured from a crash involving a traffic signal in 2011. 23 of those were killed when someone drove through a red light. There are ways to improve safety on our streets that have been proven to work in other states and cities. 25 states and over 500 cities. And one of those ways is contained in this bill that we have before us today that will allow Minnesota cities to use traffic safety cameras to enforce red light violations. It's important to say if this bill passes, no cameras are used unless a local government makes that decision. This authorizes local governments to make the decision. Every year, people are injured and others die when someone ignores a red light. We've all seen those near misses, those T-bone collisions when somebody runs a red light. What first caught my eye, I should tell you, those of you who remember Representative Len Biernat, he was the first person who carried this bill. Representative Paul Thiessen was an author of this bill. I have been an author of this bill before. I am very sad that it is taking so long for us to use this technology. But here is where it came to my attention. At the time, I represented the intersection that had the statistics of the highest injury and death rate from these crashes. And here's what you do when you get accustomed to those intersections. When the light turns green, you stay right there and you watch all the traffic, and when it stops, you start. And here's what happens on a congested street. It means you lose a little bit of every light cycle, and so a street like Snelling becomes more congested because of how we compensate for our fear of what will happen. Congestion increases, it slows down the flow of traffic. So red light cameras are an effective tool, as I said, authorized in 25 other states, in operation in more than 500 cities. And in town after town, in study after study, red light camera enforcement has been shown to be effective in reducing violations and accidents. They save lives, they reduce accidents, and they give our police time to deal with other crimes. There's always been controversy about this. I don't get it. I don't quite understand it. I have tried to deal with a number of those in the author's amendment. The violation will be the same as if a person were to receive a ticket from a police officer. A police officer will be involved and still have the discretion to decide who gets a ticket. The driver and not just the vehicle will be positively identified. Data will be protected and eventually destroyed. People will know where the cameras are located, and fines will be shared between the city and state just as they are today. We have a few videos. We're going to also have some testimony, but we have two videos that we would like to show you. They're very short. The first one requires careful reading because you're going to hear all of the critics' voices, and then you're going to see some statistics. And the second video is police officers in Illinois, I believe. So we'll show those to you very briefly, and then we'll say a little more about statistics.
Ask him, is everybody such a lousy driver?
So why do we need these cameras?
You know, the cameras are kind of annoying.
Just meant for the money.
The cameras are about money. This is what government officials use to cover up their inept budgeting skill. Study after study has been put out over the last few years showing that these photo radar cameras increase accidents.
And that's completely opposite from what we've been told.
Sitting here talking to you, I wouldn't be participating in an effort to save the red light cameras. This is about safety. We cannot address, if we had just left law enforcement with an officer walking on the sidewalk swinging a nightstick, and we hadn't changed the way we approach law enforcement for all these years, as technology changes, as vehicles become more prevalent, as phones become more prevalent, we have to change with the times. We're not just having the officer on the sidewalk anymore. We have them in cars. We have them watching camera systems to see if crimes are occurring. We have them monitoring red lights through red light cameras.
People who become aware that the technology is in use in our community, they drive better at that intersection and the other intersections around it.
4-year-old Maya Hirsch was killed as she left the Lincoln Park Zoo this weekend with her family. Well, tonight, as police move closer to charging that person of interest, CBS 2's Rafael Romo explains many are using the tragedy as a lesson in safety.
When they're behind the wheel, they're trying to get where they're going, and I think that it's conditions people to be more watchful.
I think it's important that it's a tool we can use, much like radar, much like DNA, much like all the other technology that has been emerging.
It's one thing to see a video from some other community and say, well, this problem's happening here, and another to see it actually happening in your own town.
We learned that there was 115 violations a day in a 12-hour period. Since the time we've installed the camera there now, our violations are less than 300 a month. That's a substantial reduction in the risk to the pedestrians and the motorists there, and it's been an effective program.
I thought that I'd seen pretty much everything until I started watching some of these videos, and then I look at the videos and I'm flabbergasted. We've had videos of cars going 50 miles an hour through a solid red light, inches from the back end of a car going on the cross street, and it just chills you that there wasn't an accident.
If one life is saved, if one 4.5-year-old girl, you know, someone's daughter, someone's sibling, someone's friend, is not killed by the presence of these lights or these cameras, then their value is proven.
Mr. Chair and members, traffic cameras have been in use for over a decade in cities like Atlanta, Georgia, Fort Dodge, Iowa, and Phoenix, Arizona. They have been reducing accidents and saving lives every year. We can do that here in Minnesota. I'd like to call attention to a few things in your packet. There was a woman who was going to provide testimony. Her testimony instead is in your packets, Melanie Castellano-Swanson from Wilmer, Minnesota. And she is a certified medical assistant at Hennepin County Medical Center. She speaks about the importance of traffic safety cameras on behalf of her profession, but also her son, Justin, who was killed on Christmas Eve in 2011. Witnesses say a Ford SUV ran a red light. This driver could be anyone on the road, an experienced 50-year-old driver in a hurry, or any one of us. This could happen to anyone. Mm-hmm. Statistics about death and injury, she says, are caused by that are caused by red light runners are staggering. It is time we take red light running seriously. We need to use modern technology to crack down on drivers who ignore the red lights and kill innocent people with their criminal acts. And she says, red light cameras change driver behavior, prevent injuries and fatalities, and penalize those who break the law. Red light cameras work, and Minnesota cities need this technology. That testimony is in your packets. Further, there is information from the League of Minnesota Cities policy. I believe Mayor Kleiss will speak to that, but their issue statement is available to you. And then finally, I don't believe this one got in your packet because I got it just before I came down here, and that's the Insurance Federation of Minnesota. We could get that to you later if you'd like. They support this House file, and they cite the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, and I will reference a few of those articles, which that's a national organization that conducts testing and research and has over many years definitively documented the positive benefits from the use of such cameras. They cite in 2010 that 675 people in the United States died, 122,000 were injured in accidents caused by red light running, and they say the economic costs to society of such accidents are staggering. The reason for having such cameras is not to provide income to municipalities, but rather to deter drivers from committing violations that can have a severe economic impact on our state. And then just a word about the Traffic Safety Coalition, which you saw just a little bit about. I don't think any of these are in your packet. They could be, because they had an advocacy letter. And this is signed by prominent healthcare and injury prevention advocates in the state, also on behalf of traffic safety cameras, which they say we have a responsibility to empower local law enforcement with the tools they need to effectively monitor our roads. Safety cameras do just that, enhancing the ability of police departments to enforce critical traffic safety laws and make our streets and roads safer for everyone. By changing dangerous driver behavior, safety cameras have been proven effective in reducing red light running. And they cite the following statistics. 39% reduction in fatal red light running crashes in Toledo, Ohio, according to the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety. A 67% reduction in crashes in Arlington, Texas, according to the Texas Transportation Institute. A 42% reduction in right angle crashes and 25% in rear end in Newark, New Jersey. The statistics are overwhelming, and this coalition includes RNs, nurses, and physicians from around the state. There's an injury prevention coordinator from the Mayo Clinic, the director of the Le Centre Volunteer Ambulance Service, the director of the Emergency and Urgent Care in Red Wing, Mayo Clinic in Austin, the pediatric trauma coordinator in southern Minnesota, the Truman Ambulance, trauma program manager at St. Luke's Hospital, Mayo Clinic in Mankato, Mayo Clinic in Red Wing, the OTA Volunteer Ambulance Service, and the St. Francis Medical Center. Just some of the people who have signed that as part of the Traffic Safety Coalition. This isn't anything new. In 25 states and over 500 cities around the country. And just a few more statistics. Most of these, I think, are from the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety. Enforcing traffic laws in dense urban areas by traditional means poses special difficulties. In most cases, police must follow a violating vehicle through a red light. This can endanger motorists and pedestrians as well as officers. Traffic stops in urban areas also can exacerbate congestion. I talked about specifically a street like Snelling Avenue. A 2012 Institute study in Arlington County, Virginia, found significant reductions in red light violations at camera intersections 1 year after ticketing began. A 2011 Institute study comparing large cities with red light cameras to those without found the devices reduced the fatal red light running crash by 24% and the rate of all types of fatal crashes at signalized intersections by 17%. Studies by the Institute and others have found reductions in violation rates or violations ranging in violation rates or violations ranging from 40 to 96% after the introduction of cameras. Institute studies in Fairfax, Virginia and Oxnard, California found that in addition to the decrease in red light running at camera-equipped sites, the effect carried over to signalized intersections not equipped with red light cameras. You heard one of the police officers say that in the film. I could go on and on. The research, the statistics are overwhelming, and we have some good testimony, and I'm going to be joined at the table by Mayor Kleiss from St. Cloud, and I believe also by his police chief.
Welcome, Mayor Kleiss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Dave Kleiss, Mayor of the City of St. Cloud. Appreciate the opportunity to speak to the committee and in particular to support House File 487. This is something I can speak on behalf of my city. We have passed a resolution at the city probably, I think, for the last 7 years supporting the ability for us as a city to have these cameras. Having that ability and that tool is important. I also, as was mentioned earlier, as a member of the League of Minnesota Cities, I can speak on behalf of the League. The League of Minnesota Cities does support House File 487. And also, in addition, I know the City of Burnsville also has, in their legislative agenda, has also passed a resolution, anyways, on their legislative agenda. The City of St. Cloud, and I speak on behalf of somebody who feels very strongly about this from a public safety issue. I speak not only as the mayor of the City of St. Cloud. I've owned a driver's education business for 22 years and have taught for about 27 years. And this is an issue of public safety, in particularly in area, the running of traffic signals is something I used to. I haven't taught for a number of years, but when I taught, my instructors would actually take a class out. My driving academy is near the near a highway, and I would take the class out and just have them spend an hour and write down how many people run a red light. You know, it's a little different when you're having a squad car there, or in this case, the cameras with just students with notepads. Folks tend to do what their normal behavior is, and most of that is running the red light. The chief's going to talk a little bit about some of the intersections and some of the, at least in St. Cloud, in those areas. But it's a safety issue, and it's also a matter of resources. The state and the legislature and as you know, cities and counties have had difficult times over the last several years. And from a resource aspect, one of the first things actually when I became mayor 7 years ago was to help push for this type of giving the tools. This is something I've talked to a number of my line staff officers on the tools that they need, and a number of them feel that again they'd prefer traffic issues, in the ranks of priority. They'd prefer to be doing things in areas of burglaries or assaults and some of the other crimes, but they also need the tools. And in talking to our line staff folks, they support this type of initiative. in talking to our residents, we've done surveys about folks that have wanted to have that type of enforcement and that type of support. So, you know, ideally, we don't have the resources, nor would we ever be able to have the resources to have a cop at every intersection, nor would it make sense in a priority basis. But this allows a tool to have that ability. And it also, you know, the issue for us, trying to deal with budgets and trying to deal with resources, you know, oftentimes, and you'll hear me down here, I'm actually down here earlier today for local government aid, so I'll always be down here talking about resources, those financial resources to be able to run a city and the resources that we need. But absent those resources, give us the tools to be able to actually do some things without those additional resources to deal with public safety. Public safety is an essential service. It doesn't matter what city you're in this state. It's one of those things that you expect, and it's having that tool, that ability, in this case, to have these types of cameras would make it a tremendous asset for us. We'd still have to go through the process, as was mentioned before. We'd have to pass an ordinance. We'd have to have a public hearing. We'd have to make a decision whether or not we go forward, but it gives us a tool, and safety is paramount in this area. I want to introduce Chief William Blair Anderson, talk a little bit about, you know, from the law enforcement perspective, what the safety issue is for that.
Thanks. Welcome, Chief.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for your time and consideration today. You've been given a great deal of statistics.
Give your name, Chief.
I'm sorry?
Will you repeat your name into the...
Yes, sir. William Blair Anderson.
Thank you.
The deterrent factor with red light cameras cannot be overstated. And I will couple that remark with something the mayor has already said to the committee, which is the complexity and the nature of what we have begun to do in law enforcement has shifted the paradigm for us. I would much rather be able to deploy my resources into problem-solving areas, whether it's crime reduction, outreach initiatives, or simply visibility, than to have them bogged down with something that we have a remedy to help us address. I think we would be remiss if we didn't avail ourselves of any tool that would help us become more efficient. It is one of my mantras and one that I'm positive the city supports. You know, my job as a public safety official is to ensure public safety but also efficiency. And, you know, too often we are accused of being wasteful. And to me, if there is a tool out there that would help us become more efficient and deploy our resources a little bit better, I think we should take advantage of it. And incidentally, the Office of Traffic Safety here in the state of Minnesota has identified two of the worst intersections in the state in our fair city. And so I'm looking for any help and support I can get to help mitigate that. I know all too well how gut-wrenching it is to make a death notification and how senseless it is when you have to follow that up by telling the family of that victim that it was caused because someone ran a red light. Again, you've been given a lot of numbers today, and as I take my leave of you, I'll leave you with the most important number of all the ones you'll hear, and it is one. And imagine, if you will, that one is representative of you or one of your loved ones who has become a victim because of something so senseless when we have a tool to help us mitigate that. I thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Representative Anderson, you had a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just listening to this testimony today, I hear a lot about costs and resources, but I haven't heard of what one of these intersections would cost to be outfitted with this equipment. But yet we keep talking about this as a public safety issue, and public safety is, you know, they almost become the end justifies the means. So at this point, why wouldn't we install these cameras at every single intersection? And what we only saw up there was just the traffic-controlled intersections. You know, next you could actually put these things on intersections with just stop signs, either four or two-way. People run those too. There's a lot of scenarios where people break the law. You could put stop these same cameras on railroad intersections. At what point does this become a very expensive project to cover this so-called public safety issue? Mr. Chair,
I'll take that first, and if they'd like to add, I think because of the cost of the camera, just as you don't put a police officer at every intersection, you would probably identify the several high risk. They've identified two in St. Cloud, and what they have found overwhelmingly is if you place them at several intersections and publicize that, it does have a deterrent effect and provides better adherence to the red lights all over that town. So an investment in the highest risk intersections has some spillover effect across the city.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative, go ahead.
I have to, on an annual basis, put together a budget for the city of St. Cloud and bring to the council in every August. I would make the same determinations that I do every year to determine what the best source of resources and based on statistics, based on what my folks, my experts tell me about where the most resources should go, and if in the cameras, what intersections would make the most sense to do. It would be weighed with everything else we do. Right now, however, I don't have that option. Because the legislature, pass this bill and give us the authorization, then that's another tool that I can use to make that determination. So it's whether I hire officers and put officers at those intersections, or whether I do something that's more, I believe, more cost effective and put a camera at those intersections. It'll be a decision that I have an opportunity to make, but I don't have that opportunity to make that right now.
Follow up, Mr.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Mayor. What does one of these intersections cost to outfit?
I don't know the from our perspective. Again, we'd look at the, I don't know what the actual intersection costs, but from our perspective, we'd look at it and competitively bid and find out what the best bang for the buck we're buying. But I don't know. Maybe they
offer. We'll have a vendor up here, and I know there are a number of technical questions that the committee has, and that would be a question we'll ask that person to address.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. I have a question in just regards, because I'm not sure how the ticket actually works. And so I happen to run a red light. I didn't know I did or whatever, for whatever reason. I'm assuming then I would get a ticket in the mail. Is that correct?
And, Mr. Chair, the vendor is going to come up here and answer all the technical questions. I have one more testifier, Dorian Grilly, who's with the Minnesota Bicycle Alliance, and if we could perhaps have him up, and then we'll have the technical expert in, because most of your questions, I'm guessing, will be of this type.
It was to the police officer here that I was really requiring to. I mean, my question is in regards specifically, I think, to due process. So if I'm assuming I would get a ticket, and if I happen to have ran that red light on my way to Arizona for 2 months, and I don't know that there's a ticket out there, is the police department's general rule is that after a certain period of time, there are additional violations and warrants and other stuff issued for that? I'm just kind of curious as to the actual due process on how the ticket would work if I'm not aware of it, and because of mailing and so forth, I haven't received it.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I don't know that it would be any different than the current notification process, which is controlled by the courts, as you well know, and not the police department. Failure to respond triggers a bench warrant for certain offenses, and I don't know why that would be any different. But as far as any technical, sir.
I was going to say, Mr. Chair.
Petersburg.
The difference is that if you stop me, I know I've got a ticket. And so, therefore, I'd be looking for something. If the traffic camera takes it, I don't know that I've been stopped. I don't know that I've got a ticket out there. And so that's the big difference. And I'm just wondering exactly if there's any due process determined for that.
Well, I just happen to know somebody who works in this building. I got one in the mail. They were in one of the cities that has one of these, and the notification came in the mail.
And this is strictly conjecture, sir, but I would imagine the suspense period would be a little bit longer than it would be if you were actually interacting with an officer, where we issue you a court date based on court calendars and the volume that they see on any giving day.
Do you have additional?
We just have Dorian Brilli from the Minnesota Bicycle Association Alliance, and then our technical person will be up here because I think many of the questions you have probably are for him.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'll keep this short. I'm Dorian Grilly, the Executive Director of the Bicycle Alliance of Minnesota, and we do support House File 487. Safety concerns are the number one deterrent to more people bicycling more often, and many bicycle motor vehicle crashes occur at intersections. You've heard enough statistics. I don't think I need to repeat many more of those, but it's safe to say, or the statistics did include, that a significant number of the injuries and fatalities were bicyclists and pedestrians. Traffic safety cameras would help improve safety at intersections and provide valuable documentation should a crash occur. The Bicycle Alliance supports the Toward Zero Death campaign, and we feel that this would be a valuable tool in helping toward that goal. We believe strongly that this discussion should not be about the money. It should be about preventing injuries and saving lives. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Beard?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Grilly, I'm sitting here pondering whether to support this or not, but since you brought up bicycles, I'm wondering if this can be adapted to write tickets to bicyclists as well, who pass on the right, drive down the middle of the lane, turn without signals, and, oh, by the way, blow through red lights. I'm just a question, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative
Beard. I think about those things.
Representative Beard, the Bicycle Alliance would support that. If you could find a way to identify the bicyclist, we are the bicycle education organization in the state, and we teach traffic safety, and we teach bicyclists to obey all the traffic regulations. Before I leave, I just wanted to share with you a 30-second story, a personal story. Many of you know, 2 years ago, I was hit by a car at an intersection. I believe the driver had every intention of turning right on a red light without stopping. The driver was ticketed for careless driving and several other violations and fined $500. I spent 3 weeks in Regents Hospital. It nearly killed me. So I'm very lucky to be here. And as the police chief said, I don't think we can underestimate the deterrent value of this. That may have prevented the driver that hit me from planning to run that red light.
Thank you.
And our final person, Mr. Chair, is our legal and technical expert, and I suspect many of your questions may relate to this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and representatives. My name is Craig Buskey. I'm an attorney from the law office of David L. Shulman in Minneapolis, and I represent Redflex Traffic Systems, which is one of the vendors that makes these types of traffic safety cameras. I'd like to start out by giving a quick overview of some of the legal issues, then a quick overview of some of the technical issues, and after that I'll be happy to answer your questions as best as I'm able. When talking about the legality of using traffic safety cameras, one of the things that opponents of these cameras frequently say is, aren't these unconstitutional? And that's simply not the case. And I think that misunderstanding arises out of a lack of understanding about a 2007 Minnesota Supreme Court case called State v. Kuhlman. Now, a copy of that Minnesota Supreme Court case is in those red folders that you were all given. And what that case did is dealt with the Minneapolis ordinance that governed the rules for the Minneapolis red light traffic camera program that was in place in about 2005 and 2006. What that case says is that the Minneapolis ordinances are invalid because they were in conflict with state law. Basically, the city of Minneapolis was not enforcing the laws regarding running red lights the same way that state law deals with those. And there were three primary reasons they found a conflict. The first was that Minneapolis was using traffic safety cameras to enforce red light running. The Supreme Court said municipalities are not explicitly authorized to do that under state law. And so that's one of the things that House File 487 does. It grants municipalities authorization to use those cameras, which takes care of the first conflict that the state Supreme Court found. The next two conflicts that the state Supreme Court found had to do with who was getting the ticket and what due process protections they had. Under the Minneapolis ordinances, the ticket was going to the owner of the vehicle, not the driver. And the state Supreme Court said you can't do that, because under state law, the ticket goes to the driver. Well, members of the committee, that's why House File 487 was drafted to issue the ticket to the driver. That's why it requires that the cameras be able to take a photograph of the driver's face. The final conflict that the state Supreme Court found in State v. Kuhlman was that the Minneapolis ordinances contained a rebuttable presumption that the owner of the car was the driver of the vehicle. And again, the state Supreme Court said that that was a conflict because under state law, the default penalty for running a red light is a petty misdemeanor. And with a petty misdemeanor, you're presumed innocent until proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. So you can't change that due process protection. And under House File 487, that wouldn't be changed. A driver who receives a ticket through the use of a traffic safety camera would have the same procedures available to them to challenge that ticket, and the state would have the same burden of proof just as any ticket written by an officer. So that's a quick overview of some of the legal issues. I also want to address briefly a misconception about House File 487, which is that this bill somehow authorizes the use of these cameras to enforce speed limits. That is not the case. And the reason that is not the case is, A, because as the bill is written, these traffic safety cameras don't have any capabilities of measuring speed. They're meant to capture images. And two, under existing Minnesota law, Minnesota Statute 169.14, Subdivision 10, for evidence of speed to be admissible in court, the speed monitoring device has to be operated by an officer. So an automated system measuring speed wouldn't be admissible in court under existing Minnesota law. House File 487 does nothing to change that. It doesn't attempt to do anything to change that. This bill is only about the red light run. I'm going to transition from the legal into the technical, and again, I'd just like to give a brief overview of how the cameras work. If a municipality were to decide they wanted to install these cameras at a specific intersection, they would work with a vendor, and they would come in and install a camera at the front of the intersection and at the back of the intersection, two separate cameras. And the reason for two separate cameras is so that they can take four pictures of the vehicle. And again, in those red folders you have, there's a statement of technology from Redflex with some pictures that probably explains this better than I'm able to put into words to you. I'm going to try to articulate it the best I can. Those two cameras, as I said, are able to take a picture, four separate pictures. The first picture is of the vehicle from the rear before it enters the intersection when the light is red. And that picture shows you that the car, that the light is red and that the car is about to enter the intersection. The second picture will take a photograph of the face of the driver, and that's the camera coming from the other side of the intersection. The third picture will take a photograph of the license plate of the vehicle to help identify who's driving the car. And the last picture will again be from the rear camera and will take a picture of the car after it has entered the intersection when the light is red. Now, in addition to installing these two cameras so that they can take those four photographs, they also have to install road sensors. And those road sensors are important because they tell the system when a car is going to run that red light. And that's important because these types of systems are only armed when the light is red. They're only going to capture a violation or a red light running incident when the light is red. This is not something where it's continuously downloading a nonstop stream of data. It's not a surveillance camera, I guess is the point I'm trying to make. So these sensors can sense when a car is going to enter that intersection when the light is red. And if that happens, those four pictures in the sequence I described before start being taken. In addition, the cameras actually record a 12-second video clip of the car as it is approaching the intersection and going through the intersection. And that's something that police can have access to look at and see if this was actually a red light running violation. To make sure, for example, that this wasn't flashing a ticket of a squad car with its lights on going through the intersection, or that it wasn't a funeral procession. Now, if a red light running incident is captured, if someone crosses the plane of that intersection and the light is red, that information, those four pictures and that 12-second video clip that I described for you, is then sent to the vendor, whoever the vendor might be. And the vendor has employees who will review that footage and review the picture of the face and say, okay, does this look like someone ran the red light? And can we identify the driver? And each police department that's responsible for administering these programs gets to tell the vendor when they should forward information to them and when they shouldn't. But basically, if it looks like there's a violation and you can identify the driver, then that information is sent to the local police department who's responsible for administering the program. And members of the committee, that's very important, because the final decision about whether or not to issue a violation, the final decision about when a violation occurred, is always left to the law enforcement agency responsible for administering the program. This is not a situation where you have a private company, a vendor, making these determinations. It goes to the local law enforcement officer who decides. And that local law enforcement officer, in viewing the evidence available to them, the pictures and the videos, has the same discretion as they would if they pulled someone over on the street as to whether or not to issue that violation. If the officer decides, yes, this was a violation of the law, and yes, I can see the driver of the vehicle so that we can identify them, then that officer authorizes the issuance of the citation, their electronic signature is put on the violation, and the violation is then mailed to the person who they have identified as the driver. I want to touch briefly on the question that Representative Petersburg brought up about citations being issued by mail. And unfortunately, the answer to your question is that there's a number of procedures that the courts can use if someone doesn't appear or doesn't pay a fine, so there's not a simple answer. The best I can tell you is that because running a red light under this bill would be a petty misdemeanor, if you are mailed one of those citations and you fail to appear because you didn't receive it, what's going to happen is you're going to be found guilty and you'll owe the citation fee. Then the court will send you a notice that you owe the citation fee. And these are rules that are set by the courts. These are not codified, and they're not set by the locality, so it's hard to give a distinct answer because it's a combination of rules of court and judicial decisions. But if the fine is not paid and they send out a notice, there are a number of opportunities the court has to deal with that, or options. And the court administrator or the judge presiding over the case can decide to send the unpaid fine to a collection agency. They can decide to suspend a driver's license, in which case the person has to be sent another notice at least 14 days in advance saying your driver's license may be suspended because of a failure to pay a fine. Or it is possible that a judge may decide to issue a bench warrant. Now, typically, judges don't issue bench warrants for a $125 unpaid fine. The typical instances that those are issued in are when someone has many unpaid fines. But I can't set that rule, and neither can you all. Those are rules set by the courts. And so that's the best answer I can give you. I apologize, it's not more clear. And with that, I'll conclude by thanking you for your time, and if there are any questions, I'll try my best to answer them.
Representative Dorholt, you had a question. Representative Neuberger, did you have a...
Nope.
Huh? No? Are there other questions? What? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Buskey, you say that these systems under red flex traffic systems don't record speed. Is that correct?
No, that is not correct. They are not able of measuring speed to be used to prosecute violations of speed limits. The way they anticipate whether someone is going to run the red light is by estimating speed as they approach the intersection. However, under Minnesota state law, that evidence is not admissible in court. And frankly, the technology that they use to anticipate the speed of a vehicle approaching a red light isn't accurate enough to be admitted into a court of law with the degree of precision that, for example, a radar gun would use. So they do contain an estimate of speed. However, that information could not be used under Minnesota law to prosecute violations of the speed limit.
Mr. Chairman, follow up?
Yeah, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Petersburg earlier was talking about due process. And I know of an example of somebody that did get caught up in the due process or the lack thereof for being out of the country for 2 months, and he came back to Texas. And yes, there was a warrant out. He hadn't addressed any of his mail for a couple of months. His mail had piled up. He's in trouble. So that part of this whole due process really scares me. The other thing is, okay, so what if my daughter borrowed my car and went out and was driving down, ran a red light? And would I ever have to appear to testify against my daughter? That's another due process question. I guess it's not a question for you. The other thing is, what if I've got a Halloween, a bunch of buddies, I'm in college, and I've got some buddies that put on some masks and want to just go tick me off, grab my car, and go run a red light? How are you going to address the due process on that? Because it's going to come back to me, and do I have to testify against my buddies? There's a lot of unanswered questions in here that scare me with these cameras. And I know you don't have the answer, but I think it's something that everybody here should be thinking about today. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, if I may respond. Mr. Chair, Representative, I think I can answer at least a portion of the issues you raised. As far as the due process with the mailing of violations, I understand your concern. The fact of the matter is that under Minnesota Rule of Criminal Procedure 3, the courts have stated that service of a summons and complaint, service of a violation by mail, is effective and lawful. And using that system to mail the citations, in this case, does provide the same due process protections as any other violation. It is true that it is being sent by mail, and I understand your point that there are instances when someone might not get their mail, and there are issues of that when these programs are in place. Those types of situations can occur. What I can tell you is that if one of those were to occur, you'd have the same rights to appeal that citation, appeal that violation, as you would for any other violation. As far as your daughter driving your car, the way police departments deal with that is that when the officer is sent the footage and the photographs of the violation, the officer has the ability to look at the driver's license photo and compare the driver's license photo to the photo from the violation to see if they match before the citation is sent out. Now, if they look at those and they think they match, then they can send them out. If they look at those and they don't match, the officers will be on notice that they have the burden of proof of proving the person they issued the citation to is the same person that's on the video that's being shown run the red light. And so at that point, the local officers have the discretion to make a determination about how much investigation they want to do to try to determine who was driving your car. I know for a fact that officers can say, look at the address attached with your car registration or your driver's license and say, all right, let's look and see if someone else lives at that address. And they can see, oh, your daughter lives at that address. Let's look at her driver's license photo. Does that match? Yes, that matches. Okay, they'll send it to your daughter. In some instances, they might say, for example, if someone's driving a car and wearing a mask, the officer has to look at that and say, I can't tell who this is based on this recording, this picture. And again, it's the officer's discretion how much they want to investigate that. I can tell you that across the country, typically what happens in that kind of situation is that no citation is issued. But an officer would have the discretion, for example, to say, well, this car is registered to this address. Go to that address, knock on the door, and say, do you know who is driving the car? And if you answer the door, your responsibility to provide truthful answers to that officer are the same as they would be if that officer was investigating any other crime.
We're going to run out of time here before long. I've got a couple other people on the list, so we might go there first. Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions. First for Representative Hausman. Is this your final testifier here today?
It is.
Mr. Chair, Representative, do we have anything or have you spoken to anybody from the judicial system in terms of their position on this particular bill?
Representative Hausman.
This bill, I believe, goes to at least four committees.
Yeah.
So those parts of the bill, I suspect, will be addressed in two of those other committees.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. Do you have for us, first a question. I believe you talked about capturing a section of video or a number of seconds of video. Do these cameras also have ability to take still photos? And in addition to that, maybe I missed it in the packet, but do you have a sample of the photos that we could see?
Representative, Mr. Chair, I do not have a sample of the photos that you can see, and the reason for that is privacy concerns. I, as an attorney for Redflex, don't have access to that data. So unfortunately, no, I do not. As far as the capabilities of the cameras, though, as it has been described to me, yes, they can record approximately a 12-second video clip, and in addition to that, they can record four still images. And when the citations are sent out, the citation will actually have one or more of those images printed on the citation so that the person receiving it can take a look at it and see, wow, is this picture me or not? But unfortunately, I don't have a physical example for you.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
And this will be my final question, but we've talked a little bit, or I've heard you talk a little bit about officers' discretion, which is good. But I also think I heard in your testimony you talked about a private company or a vendor that would review and determine or make some determination if it was something that they would send on to law enforcement to make that decision. So I'm just wondering if you can A, address that a little bit more clear for me, and B, and I don't know if we'll run out of time or not, but B, my question would be, where does the data go? Right? I mean, is it stored someplace off-site, or does it go to the vendor? I'm curious about the process.
Mr. Busby.
Mr. Chair, Representative, as far as the vendor review process goes, that's part of the service agreement that the vendor enters into with the municipality. And what they do when they review that footage is whatever the municipality tells them to do. So if, for example, in a municipality, there's a police officer or a police department that says, we want you to send us every single thing you get, that's what the vendor will do. If there's a police department that says, as part of your service contract, we want you to review these first and see if someone actually ran through the red light before you send them on to us, that's what they'll do. If the police department wants to say, we want you to review these and only send us pictures where someone ran the red light and you have a clear image of the driver, that's what they'll do. So again, it's the discretion resides with the police department and the officers making those determinations. The vendor is simply, as a service to them, filtering out instances which the police department doesn't want to receive. But the police department is making that determination and telling the vendor what to do. As far as where the information goes, when a red light running incident is detected, and again, I can only speak for the company that I represent, Redflex, but my understanding is that all the vendors work approximately the same way. That information, that incident, is downloaded onto a secure server at the vendor's headquarters or at a vendor's facility. And as far as Redflex goes, all those facilities are in the United States, and the municipality who's contracting with that has the authority to say where that data goes. Some of it, for example, in California, it has to stay within the state. In other states, it gets sent to the headquarters in Phoenix, but that's part of the contract the municipality comes up with. The officers then have access to that data through a secure server. Now, under our amendment, once that data is downloaded, it can only be kept for 30 days past the date of final adjudication, and then it has to be, you know, gotten rid of. So if you receive one of these in the mail, you send in a check to pay it, they record it, they have 30 days to get rid of that data.
Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hausman, thank you for bringing this forward. It's very interesting, and I can see some very good aspects. And to your testifier, does this, first of all, Representative Simonson asked the question that I was interested in. You would think that the vendor would have a photo so we could actually see what it looks like, and it could be a company person. But furthermore, talking about video, is there a possibility of this being used for surveillance?
Mr. Chair, Representative, again, I apologize for not having an example for you. I should have done that. There is a way to set up an example shot with, for example, a company employee. I unfortunately don't have that for you. And as to your second question, as far as using these for surveillance, the way the cameras are installed, they get about 6 seconds of what they call buffering. And if there is no recorded violation in that 6 seconds, then that goes away and is recorded over. These are cameras, and yes, if additional equipment were added to them, they could be turned into surveillance cameras. However, I would say that there are already surveillance cameras on practically every street corner in downtown Minneapolis and St. Paul, and that trying to use these for those purposes wouldn't make much sense, and that's not their intended purpose. Yes, the technology exists to do so, but these are targeted in intersection, and the way the cameras are initially equipped, they only record information, images, if they detect a violation.
Representative
Thank
Rosenthal.
You, Mr. Chair. And just, you know, I understand this bill would have to go through a lot of committees, probably civil law, data practices, public safety. And if it does take that route, I would really urge you to bring some photographs.
Thank you.
Representative Fitzsimmons.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hausman, again, I thank you for bringing this. It's I do have some concerns, though. One is, you know, we keep hearing it called the red light camera, and the technology being described is about red lights, but I'm just concerned if the language is that is there too much opening in the language to allow for more that I just, you know, I'm concerned about allowing more than what the discussion we're having is actually talking about, and I just wondered if you've heard that concern or have already addressed it, or if I'm missing something. But in the conversation, we keep going back to kind of calling it red light, and it's all about that. But is that really what we're only allowing in what we have on our language?
And the underlying bill, Mr. Chair, House File 487, just in the description of traffic safety camera, we describe movement at an intersection. I guess we changed it somewhat in the amendment. Means a remotely operated recording device capable of recording clear images of both vehicle movement at an intersection and the driver of the vehicle. So we literally limit it to an intersection.
Right, and that's what it says the traffic safety camera can do, but if it's capable of doing that, I guess, you know, my question revolves around, I mean, is this if it has the capability, can a police department, you know, run checks on driver status? Can they run checks on insurance status? I mean, I just want to make sure we're matching our law with what our conversation is about, I guess, is my concern.
I understand that, and I think you define it so that it matches what you've added in law, and that would be lines 120-121, regulating traffic by means of police officers, traffic control signals, or traffic safety cameras. Then you'd have to go back to the definition to see how narrowly limited is that definition that you've added.
Right, because we're adding a definition for safety cameras. But I guess then mine is what's the definition of regulating traffic, and if regulating traffic is any traffic law or potential violation, is the language open enough that allows for that? And I'm not even saying that then says it shouldn't be passed. I'm worried about our conversation matching the legal definition.
I'm looking at our wordsmith over there whether he has a different sense.
Mr. Chair and members, my reading of this is just initial, and really this would take a court determination to decide, but my sense of it would be that regulating traffic would be regulating various provisions in Chapter 169. That would include speeding, motor vehicle passing, running red lights, turns, you know, full set of motor vehicle requirements in the context of that statute.
Okay. And my question then to Mr. Burris, do you believe that adding that definition, we still need to tighten the language?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, I missed a little bit of the discussion, so I'm not quite clear on that piece of your question.
We can maybe
question.
Talk
sure.
about that.
Yeah, Mr. Burris, I think my discussion was that our conversation's revolving around red lights and running of red lights, but my interpretation of the language is it's pretty open, and I think you just confirmed that, you know, to tabs or anything else that maybe a particular department chose to look at those photos and examine and make determinations. And again, I just want to make sure our conversation, what we think we're passing, if we think we're passing a red light and it's actually any traffic control, I just have some concern about that.
And so thank you for raising that, and we'll I'll perhaps have a chance to consult with Mr. Burris just to see if there's more clarifying language.
Thank you, Mr. Burris.
Before we go past the midnight deadline, I'm going to call up, Dennis Flattery, Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, and Brian Rice, Minneapolis Police Federation. We can come back to this for questions and so forth.
Good afternoon, members. For the record, my name is Dennis Flaherty, and I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, which is a group of about 8,500 rank and file police officers that work throughout the state. And I am here today to oppose House File 487. Across our country, and in fact across internationally, municipalities are attracted to the use of cameras in law enforcement, largely due to the promise of reduced crashes and increased revenue from the issuance of citations. While the results of studies most often show some reduction in angle crashes, they also show an increase in rear-end crashes at these intersections. Interestingly, when I did some research, I found out that much of the research has been conducted by the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, which itself is largely funded by automobile insurance companies. PhotoCop is revenue-driven, and make no mistake that this is what this bill is all about. That is the incentive behind these efforts. These programs create more ill will towards police than almost any other single enforcement effort that we might get involved with. the ill will is not towards the city officials that rally for the use of cameras, but instead at the police, because it's the police mailing the ticket to them. Revenue-driven enforcement is absolutely detested by the public. They also see a huge conflict of interest when they find out that private companies are paid a commission from the tickets that are issued. In San Diego in 2009, a court threw out the use of camera enforcement, citing, quote, lack of oversight and the method of compensation made evidence from cameras, quote, so untrustworthy and unreliable that it should not be admitted. In 2011, Arizona decided not to renew their contract with the camera vendor following a study of their 76 statewide photo enforcement efforts, citing, quote, less than expected revenues, mixed public acceptance, and mixed data. Also, in June 2011, Edmonton, Alberta canceled all 100,000 tickets issued by their photocop program due to concerns over reliability. Currently, in Iowa, there's a bill that recently has won House approval that would take revenues generated from local enforcement efforts of photocop enforcement and transfer it to the state's road use tax fund. The bill would allow the cities to keep a portion of the collections necessary to pay for the administrative costs of operating the camera, but not to profit from them. Their governor has said that he would sign the bill if it is sent to them. Obviously, the cities are strongly opposing this measure, but the author has said it's hoped that this offsets the public resentment, and apparently they're using it in about four cities in Iowa. Nothing can substitute having direct contact with an officer to correct driving behavior, whether that means they issue a ticket, a written warning, or just a strong verbal warning. There is no substitution for that. Plus, only an officer stopping a car can arrest motorists that are impaired, that might not even have a driver's license, or have no auto insurance, or have an outstanding warrant. Cameras cannot replace that value to the community. Instead, some want to go to a system where someone's going to find out who the registered owner of the vehicle is, run the driver's license of the registered owner, and if the camera photo is close to that on the driver's license of the registered owner, a citation will be sent to the owner at the address on the license. If it's a correct address, well, then we can assume the citation was received. If it isn't, we will assume that it will be returned. But really, how often do you send out mail that never comes back, and then you later hear it had never been received? This is an important element because tickets not paid can, and they do, turn into license suspensions. So someone issued a ticket through a photocop program could easily find themselves arrested, maybe even their cars towed, when they never realized that they were even cited. Testimony previously really kind of glossed over that point. The fact of the matter is, if you do not respond to a citation, there are consequences. When an officer hands you a citation and then you fail to take action, then you become responsible for whatever action develops. Our association does not feel that this is the direction that as a state we should go. We know the financial condition that some cities find themselves in today, but the promise of profits from the motoring public should not be considered. Traffic enforcement must be left to the discretion of police officers. Not every traffic violation should or has to result in a ticket. You can change people's behavior any number of ways. Maybe a citation is one, but maybe a good strong verbal warning might also accomplish the same thing. And when you take discretion away from police officers, that is very, very problematic. Technology, as advanced as it may be, should not be relied on in this area of enforcement. And so I would urge you not to support this effort.
Next.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Brian Rice. I'm an attorney in Minneapolis and registered lobbyist for the Police Officers Federation of Minneapolis. I've had the committee clerk circulate a letter that's signed on by Lieutenant John Delmonico, who's the president of this organization. We represent, he represents approximately 900 police officers in Minneapolis. It's the single largest law enforcement unit in the state. There's about 10,000 police officers in the state. I understand we're under some time issues, but I would really encourage the committee to very carefully consider this legislation, and the Police Officers Federation of Minneapolis is strongly opposed to it. I'll go through briefly. I do think that Mr. Flaherty has made an enormous point. When you invoke the judicial system and all its consequences on citizens of the state, it's a very, very serious matter. You have law enforcement officers who are sworn and taught and understand what the laws that this legislature decrees. You ask them to enforce that. They're trained. They're licensed. They're in many ways under your purview as the legislature. And they're it's an enormous matter, quite frankly, if you're stopped for a ticket or arrested for anything. Once you invoke the consequences of our judiciary, it's very serious on your person and your property. And to do so, I would submit, merely by electronic technology is a very, very important question for this committee to consider. As Mr. Flaherty said, having a police officer on the scene is very important. Not only if there's a red light violation, frequently there may be a red light violation, a drunk driving violation, somebody driving without insurance, and all of those things have other consequences that flow from that. And we appreciate the safety concerns that have been raised by the advocates, but if these photo cops become the norm and traffic enforcement doesn't exist, I'd ask the committee to consider the number of drunk drivers that we leave on the road because we're not apprehending them, people without insurance, people who perhaps are have warrants issued for them for other matters, and frequently traffic stops are the most dangerous matter a police officer faces. That's the biggest incident of police officer death and injury. As witness the recent Decker officer was investigating someone, stopped a car, confronted him in an alley, and died as a result of that. But that's where really good police work happens, when it's a face-to-face exchange between a police officer and a citizen. Mr. Flaherty did note the issue about technology and privacy, and there was some questions raised about what happens to this. Now, there may be a protocol, and of course we know there was a protocol in the Department of Natural Resources where one individual accessed literally thousands of people's files. Now, he violated the law, he was caught, he was fired. But once you create this technology, once you give access to even a public employee, let alone a private vendor, a number of other consequences can flow. You've opened up a box, a window, to what appears to be private vendors to basically have access to the records of every citizen in this state who has a driver's license. And I would say this question was raised about Big Brother. For those of you who didn't read it, I think you might find of interest a story that appeared in the paper in Minneapolis today. And the case that the gentleman referred to involves Minneapolis. The city of Minneapolis, several years ago under its charter, attempted to create photocop in its city. It lasted for about 9 months. It was ruled it violated your uniform traffic laws. The Supreme Court said it violated the act. The testifier before is correct. It did not talk about constitutional issues, but that was because the city, the legal question there was whether the city had the authority under its home rule charter, general welfare authority, to enact this ordinance. And the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals said, no, it did not, because it did not comply with your traffic laws. That's why this bill is here, for the legislature to authorize it. But as has been noted, for this committee to move forward, it'll have to go to the judiciary and other policy committees to review those issues. We would urge you to not let that bill go this far, because this will invoke our Bill of Rights. It will invoke issues of privacy. Probably one of the best justices of the Supreme Court in the last century was Louis Brandeis, and he was quite a legal scholar. But he did something that was extremely significant before he got on the Supreme Court. And he was one of the first people to clearly articulate this right of privacy that we have in this country that's been well established. He wrote a supremely important law review article while he was a lawyer, and he talked about the tension between government and technology and individuals and liberty. And that is really what we have at stake today here. And it's a balancing act that this legislature has to draw in many, many cases. And that's, we have this pervasive technology. It can be used in a number of ways. And it's something I would really urge you to think about. In Minneapolis, they put an ordinance in, and literally hundreds of thousands of cars go through these intersections. Tens of thousands of tickets were issued and warrants, fines collected. Eventually, it was all rebated. In today's paper, the city of Minneapolis has said it's entered into a contract with IBM, I believe, to spend $2.8 million to start tying together all the data that the city of Minneapolis collects in any facet in their city to fight crime, to look at hot spots, to do something else. The council member, Betsy Hodges, said this was not big government. Well, my father told me long ago, when somebody comes up to you and says, this is not about this issue, you got a pretty good chance that it is about this issue. And I'm serious. You keep investing in government more information and more technology, and the city is going to spend $2.8 million to integrate all the data that they can to help them fight crime and engage in other things. And it may be perfectly good idea and perfectly useful, but photocops in a number of these intersections in Minneapolis is going to collect a mass amount of data. There will be a number of tickets issued. I don't know what a red light ticket is now. I'm sure it's well north of $100. It not only is there the financial penalty, it's the invocation of this judicial system. If you didn't do it, you're going to have to fight it. If you did do it, you'll have to fight it. Once you get that ticket, it's going to be well more than $100 worth of your time, or $200. And I think that it's some of the questions, Representative Fitzsimmons, you raised an excellent one about the traffic issue. As I read the bill, I think you can go much beyond once you have the data. Your council said it's anything in 169, which is the traffic laws, which includes just about any of us who took driver's instructions would understand what the rules of the road are, and there are many. So I would certainly, on behalf of the Police Federation, we'd urge you not support this bill, because we do think it raises many, many serious fundamental issues. Thank you.
Representative Hornstein?
Well, thank you. I want to thank Representative Houseman. You've taken on some tough issues this session, and I appreciate that very much. And, you know, I do think that it seems that it's unusual that we have a bill that has like a split in law enforcement, because we had law enforcement officials for and against this today. But, you know, our and there are definitely some gray areas legally that are important. But, you know, I think our jurisdiction here is around traffic safety, and one of our main jurisdictions. And I want to return to some of the original testimony, which is that the data is very clear. This saves lives and reduces crashes. And I think that's critically important. It, even though it's not analogous to the primary seatbelt, it's definitely an apples and oranges issue, but there were definitely libertarian questions raised about that for many years in this legislature. And then we finally passed that bill, I think, in 08, 09, and it was very clear. We're saving lives every year because we have primary seatbelt. And so we'll save lives every year because of this legislation. So I think in the end, that's what's really important, and that's why I'm going to support your bill today, Representative Houseman, or whenever we vote on it.
Just an add-on to that, we were the last state in the United States to pass a primary seatbelt law, and there were some $40 million in federal money that came to us that we almost lost. And I was trying to decide if that was the Germans or the Scandinavians in this country that held us off so long. I don't know. Just a thought. Dorhol, Representative Dorhol.
What was it? Mr. Rice?
Yes.
I have a question for you. As was pointed out by Representative Hortz, you know, law enforcement is split. I'll explain. My first reaction to this bill was, no thanks, until, well, I'm a little upset. You referenced Officer Decker as responding to a traffic stop, a light.
Mr. Chairman, no, I did. If I came off the way, no, he was not.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure that's correct.
Yeah.
I do believe he was responding to a welfare check.
Correct. Okay. I mean, as I understood the fact that, Mr. Chairman, my point was is that it's the officer interacting with the public, and that was a tragic circumstance, but yeah. No, it was not a red light. No, it was not.
Okay. No, but yes. And I just, my immediate reaction was like many of yours, like, why do we need this? Like the video we saw. And my stance on this has changed drastically over maybe the past couple hours. Thinking about, I do believe, Mayor Dave, we have two of the top five deadliest intersections. Two of the top five deadliest intersections. One of which I have drive through with my 13-month-old daughter every day I pick her up from daycare. And Representative Hausman, I think, started this off at how many times do we sit at a busy intersection and watch somebody drive through? And I kid you not, I had to reflect on that, because on 8th and Highway 15, or 3rd Street and Highway 15 in my town, you can sit there every day, every afternoon, and watch two or three cars fly through that. Yeah, we wait for it to turn green, and then we go. And those folks know there's not a police officer watching that intersection. I don't know where they park and how they do it. It would be tough. So I just wanted to point that out. But and emphasize, my initial reaction to this was the same that so many of us have today. Was this is an invasion of privacy. This is gonna, you know, prevent Mr. Flaherty had a good point. I mean, I got a ticket for running red light, and the officer who the sheriff actually pulled me over and talked to me. Yeah, I'd slow down for a long time, but I don't see that preventing other folks from doing that. So just once again, his initial reaction was no. This is silly. This is overreach. This is just more money for the city of St. Cloud. But I'd ask anybody here to come and sit at that intersection at Highway 15 and 3rd Street with a 15-month-old in your back seat and not cringe. Just I ask you to reconsider what your initial reaction to this bill is.
In view of the lateness of the hour here, has anybody got one more question that they haven't thought of asking? You guys have asked so many questions that I think we have a... Oh. You are on the list. Representative Anderson or Representative Petersburg? Who's first? Flip a coin.
Well, I just have a clarifying question because, I've heard some conflicting information, and I just wanted to know from the two attorneys. I think Attorney Buskey started out by saying that there's a misunderstanding that these cameras are unconstitutional, and he cited Minnesota versus Coleman. And then I've heard another attorney that say that's not the case. And so I'm wondering, is there a place in the citation that you can show me where that court case says that they were constitutional?
Representative Anderson. Oh, excuse me. We got to come on up. I'm sorry.
Just for clarification.
Mr. Chair, Brian Rice again. You have, I believe, a copy of the decision in your packet. The issue before the court was whether or not the Minneapolis ordinance was permitted by the general state traffic laws, and the court held in that case that it was not. The testifier or the attorney for Redflex was correct. There was not a constitutional issue presented in the case. I would submit, however, just as Minneapolis tried to craft an ordinance that fit the state law, what you are doing now is the legislature trying to develop a law that will fit not only if you have the authority to do it, but you are constrained by the Constitution. And I would submit that there's going to be constitutional issues as this matter moves forward and arguments that will be made if it is passed, whether in fact this law will meet the due process requires of the Constitution or the right to face your accuser. And other issues.
Representative Anderson, are you on to answer the same? Go ahead. Representative Buskey?
Mr. Chair, Representative, just to clarify, my point was that there is not a Supreme Court case in this state holding that these are unconstitutional. which is one of the criticisms that are frequently levied at them. Mr. Rice is correct. The State v. Kuhlman case didn't address constitutional issues.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad that Mr. Buskey is back at the table because I have a question that, since he represents a company that makes these, I'm still not convinced. I'm still scared, and I'm about ready to be led down the cost issue because I haven't heard this yet. If I'm a municipality, I want to throw in 10 of these. What does just one of them cost?
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Mr. Buskey.
There's not a straightforward answer because every intersection is different. I can give you a range, though. The range for installing these at an intersection generally would range from $100,000 to $150,000 per camera. That's my estimate.
Representative, you have a follow-up or no?
No, I just...
Okay. Representative Beard, do you have your hand up there?
Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair, just a comment in general. Are we going to vote on this today, or are we going to hold this over for more consideration?
I think we'll vote.
All right. Well, Mr. Chair, then I'm compelled just to make a few comments. Because, you know, one of the most important programs we've had over the last decade is the Towards Zero Deaths program, where we've taken highway deaths in the state from over 650 a year to about 350, I think we're heading for this year, which are amazing trend lines. Some of it's enforcement, a lot of it's engineering, and just working smarter. We like to do these things because they're good ideas, not because in the case of the .08 or the traffic seat belts, some of that was just, I think, a little bit of passive-aggressive Minnesota rebellion because the feds told us to do it and threatened our highway funding. That's a horrible way to run, to inspire legislation. We should do it because it's the right thing to do, not because Washington's ordering us to do it and threatening our highway funding. So, yes, we did it, oh, by the way. And this is one of those where Washington's not ordering us. We're actually agonizing over the discussion about what's the right thing to do, as it should be. That's the end of my editorial comment about Washington. But about this matter, you know, this is an important issue and one we've wrestled on bipartisanly for a couple of years. And if you want to talk about traffic safety, which is job one at MnDOT, and I think we're all agreed to that, there's a lot of things we've done and we could do that we have not discussed here yet today. Lengthening yellow signals has had a dramatic impact on reducing red light crashes. In Scott County, one of the things we've done, I think I've seen in other parts of the state, on signals on major highways where the speeds are up, we've gone to an advanced warning system where the yellow lights begin to flash and tell you this signal is going to change. If you're doing the speed limit, you probably want to get off the gas now. That's had a dramatic impact on high-speed crashes, particularly at rural signaled intersections. There's a host of things like this we haven't even touched on here today that have actually accomplished what we're trying to do without even beginning to have the hint of impugning our civil liberties. And that's my concern, is that there's more we can do without going this route yet, and we haven't explored those or even vetted those in this committee yet. $150,000 an intersection. Mr. Chairman, you know I love railroads. For $250,000, you can put a set of crossing guards. We could do that at intersections for probably $400,000. Then there wouldn't be any tickets, any fines, and it would be very clearly defined that when the arm came down, you had to stop. You couldn't run that light without breaking the crossing arm. We could do that. We haven't even talked about that yet. Instead, what we have is something that...
Would you like to talk about that?
You know, we might want to. As if we're actually going to go towards zero deaths, and we are, one of the constant discussions we have, and I'm being somewhat facetious with the crossing arms, Mr. Chair, because there's other things you do, like little posts that pop up out of the ground to tear your transmission off, and all kinds of things that we actually do at railroad crossings, people. They actually, those things do happen. Those lights start to flash, the gates start coming down, there are posts that pop up out of the ground so you cannot get in front of a train that's going more than 110 miles an hour. The technology is there, and it's actually done in some cities. My point is this. The balancing act we have is, at what point do we say we're saving lives, but we're going to impinge people's civil liberties? That's the balancing act we're being asked to consider here today. And I'm just going to submit to you, there's a lot more we can do from an engineering perspective, an investment perspective, without getting mixed up in, are we really saving lives, or are we creating a revenue stream? How much? Who pays for this? Why is a private company involved in the whole business? As much as the cops can really annoy me whenever they pull people over, nonetheless, that still is American Jewish jurisprudence, I'm trying to say, where you can face your accuser. And an officer is actually standing there with discretion to either give you a lecture or throw the book at you, depending on what he thinks you need at the moment. That doesn't happen in this case. We've taken that out of the situation. So, Mr. Chairman, there's just some thoughts as we consider this bill, and we're about to vote on it. So,
Mr. Chair, I do actually have the statistics on the longer yellow. While the longer yellow reduced red light violations by 36%, adding camera enforcement further cut red light running by another 96%. That was just one of the studies. But here is one of the things our state is doing. Signalized intersections can be replaced altogether by roundabouts, which have a dramatically fewer injury crashes. See, I knew we'd get that kind of reaction. I thought I would just mention, if you're looking for the other things, but they do go on to say, however, it is not feasible to replace every traffic light with a roundabout. But, I mean, you are right, but those things have not been popular either, as you know. Mr. Chair, I don't know if you want me to make some concluding comments,
yes,
and I didn't know if you were going to hold this over or what your plan was, but I confess
think
that... I will, I'll have to, my blood is still sort of boiling from that last testimony because, I mean, there was sort of unbelievable fear-mongering, including one phrase I wrote down, traffic enforcement disappears, as though these cameras are going to take over all the work of police. That was the phrase. And the suggestion about raising revenue. This is in use in 25 states and over 500 cities and has been in place for a very long time. Statistics are overwhelming in terms of the outcomes of that. But one more comment from one of the surveys. National surveys indicate widespread support for red light cameras. At the same time, opponents of automated enforcement have become increasingly vocal, claiming that camera programs are revenue-generating schemes that violate drivers' privacy. And here's the quote. Somehow, the people who get tickets because they have broken the law have been cast as the victims. We rarely hear about the real victims, the people who are killed or injured by these lawbreakers. And that is why I am bringing this forward. The statistics of injury and death are overwhelming. And I heard no solution from the police officers.
Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd just like to make a few comments here before we take a vote. But before I do, Representative Hausman, I want to thank you for doing this. From what I know of you, I really appreciate your passion, and I share your passion for what it is you're trying to do, and I don't think that... I don't think there's very many times that we're going to disagree, but this, unfortunately, might be one of them. Some of you may know that I've spent my entire career in public safety, maybe not in law enforcement, but nonetheless in public safety. So when we talk about a number of these things, I understand it. And I don't think that there's anyone in this room that would more wish to prevent unnecessary deaths, fatalities, and the damage that it causes to families than I do. But I think in this particular case that this is the wrong approach, and I just want to make a couple of comments as to why. We've talked a lot and heard a lot of testimony about, and we saw some video today about problem intersections or what might be labeled as problem intersections. And over the years, as I'm sitting here and I'm listening and I'm thinking back to some of the cases in my own area or around the state or even into Wisconsin where I've watched some of these problem intersections develop as traffic has increased and behaviors have changed and how it's been addressed. And I think of the process that these things go through and things that are looked at like quantity of accidents, possibly the severity of the accidents, changes in traffic flow or behaviors, coupled with just general impression from the community as well as from an engineering perspective. And the question usually comes up once these areas are identified is how do we solve this? How do we correct this problem? How do we minimize these accidents? How do we reduce our traffic fatalities? And some of the answers or potential solutions, if you will, have been talked about here today. It's been mentioned that, you know, having a law enforcement officer on every corner is an unaffordable answer, and I agree. It's not reality. It's not realistic to think that that's going to happen. And quite frankly, you know, I would question what that would resolve anyways. As I looked at this video that we watched today, we saw a number of accidents that happened that I'm not convinced that if we'd had two or three officers standing on that corner that some of those would have been prevented. And I say that in all honesty, that there are some things that we just can't prevent, and that might be one of them. And you have to drill back into each individual incident and why did the person run the red light? You know, there may have been other contributing factors, and oftentimes are. So I don't think a cop on every corner is necessarily the answer, and quite frankly, I don't think that anybody's realistically thinking that that's going to happen. I think that as I look back and I think about some of these problems that have been solved, that, and I agree with some of the things that have been said today, that engineering oftentimes is the most effective way to address some of these things. And we heard earlier testimony when we talked about the Highway 14 project about some of the benefits of that project should it come into effect about reducing traffic fatalities in that area, and I tend to agree with that. All that being said, my comments today are in no way meant to take away from anyone's particular loss. I have been to many traffic accidents and fatalities over the years, and I had no intention on taking away from that at all. I am concerned with due process rights. That is one of my primary concerns with this bill. And I think that when we give, we being the state, gives local jurisdictions the authority with the option to do something or not to do something, we create a system that will lead to inconsistency. When we talk about these systems being potentially in various cities across the state, those individual cities would have the individual right to contract with different vendors. Perhaps we heard from one here today, but I'm guessing that there are more out there. And we don't really know what the impact of that is going to be, but I'm confident that we're going to create some inconsistency. When we do create inconsistency, I think that we also have the potential to create competing case law, which is problematic in my mind. And I'm quite certain that I would bet a significant amount of money that if this were to happen, that it would just be a matter of time before we'll be back to the Supreme Court. My final comments, Mr. Chair, and then I'll wrap up, but I think that private vendors involved in any form of law enforcement is the wrong approach. And I understand the technology issue, and I understand that it's you know, potentially not cost-effective for law enforcement to review these things and be able to do that. But I think that what I heard today was that it would be up to the local jurisdiction, of course, but if the local jurisdiction directed the vendor to review the tapes and then determine which particular instances went to law enforcement for review, I mean, I'm not an attorney, but I can see holes all over that. I have a problem with that. So, and my last point, and I'm going to wrap up, but I know it's not the purview of this committee to talk about the judicial system, but I think that we've heard a number of things today that maybe aren't under the purview of this committee, and that's a question that I have too. So I'm not comfortable with this, and again, I appreciate you bringing it forward, and I appreciate the passion, and if I thought it was a good idea, I'd be all over it, but I'm not going to be able to support it today. Thank you.
Representative Hausman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fitzsimmons raised one issue that I do think does require clarity in this committee. And I don't know if you would consider, Mr. Chair, I'm not a member of the committee, so I can't make the motion, but to lay the bill over, because I do think the one issue that was raised does remain in the purview of this committee because it has to do with that definition. So I'm just suggesting that to you as a possibility that unless you feel...
I've had an epiphany, and I'm going to lay this bill over for possible something. Thank you. Thank you all.